Bo! Donna! Beckham cried. Smoke burned his eyes, and the scent of charred flesh filled his nostrils. Horn coughed deep and hard. Dark columns of smoke rose from dozens of craters. Bodies lay strewn across the field of destruction. Beckham only knew they had reached Bo and Donna's tent because it was the center of the camp, and strips of burned red plastic had survived the inferno. He didn't see any bodies in the remains, but corpses lay twisted in one of the nearby craters. Most were mangled and burned beyond recognition, but one of the victims was still moving. Beckham ran over and bent down next to the man. He was hurt bad, his legs charred. Most of his hair had been singed away, leaving a glossy red and black scalp.
"Medic!" Beckham yelled.
He put a hand on the man's shoulder, hoping it wasn't Bo. The man turned, but he had no eyes left to look at Beckham.
My God.
Beckham felt guilty when he felt a wave of momentary relief that it wasn't Bo.
"Hold on, man. Help is coming," Beckham said. "Just stay still, okay?"
A soldier came running over with a medical bag and crouched next to the injured man. Beckham nodded at the medic and then ran to Horn. He knelt next to a victim draped over another body. The big guy looked up at Beckham, tears running down his eyes.
"Bo," Beckham said quietly.
The teenager had valiantly shielded his mom's body with his own. But his heroic efforts had been futile. A touch to her burned neck confirmed they were both gone. Chapter 12. Kate walked side by side with Carr and Sean down a passage of the USS George Johnson. Accompanying them now was a computer engineer named Sammy Tybalt, a former military contractor specializing in cyber warfare and technology. The war had brought her back to helping the Allied States. She was whip smart, and it helped with testing their neural network hypothesis. Sammy had a tangle of tattoos, dragons, phoenixes, and lions, interwoven in a colorful tapestry along her arms. Kate didn't bat an eye at the ink, but Sammy's dark hair was knotted in long dreadlocks. A bit unconventional, Kate thought, but she knows what she's doing. Carr, Kate, and Sean had spent the night locked away and working in the lab with Sammy, oblivious to what was happening outside the airtight fishbowl, until Ringgold had come to check on them earlier. The president had informed Kate that her husband and Horn had gone out on a mission and had returned.
"I'm sorry for not telling you sooner, but I wanted to wait until I had better intel," Ringgold had said.
Kate's first reaction was anger, but that had passed. All that she cared about was that Reed and Horn were okay. Knowing that had helped get her through the early morning hours. Aside from that, though, she had no idea how the other outposts had fared during the night. Exhaustion and worry weighed on her, but the knowledge she carried with her after a night of experiments was enough to keep her going. They now better understood the role the red webbing in the variant tunnel played in communication with the collaborators. It had also brought them to an insurmountable roadblock, and they needed the president's help. Sailors and other crew members flowed past them until they reached a hatch with two Marines standing guard. "Dr. Lovato, Dr. Carr, Sammy Tybalt, and Sean McMasters," Kate said, holding up an ID card. "We're here to meet with President Ringgold." One of the Marines squinted at her ID before locking eyes with her. He then opened the hatch. They stepped into a space with a U-shaped table. Chairs lined each side, and a large monitor was mounted to the bulkhead. Already seated were President Ringgold, Vice President Lemke, General Souza, and Lieutenant Festa. Chief of Staff James Soprano stood in a corner with his arms folded. The dark circles under Ringgold and Souza's eyes showed Kate she wasn't the only one who had missed out on some shut-eye. No doubt the attacks last night had kept them occupied.
"Did you bring me some hope?" Ringgold asked. "Yes, but we need your help, Madam President," Kate said. "Starting with some coffee."
Soprano disappeared out of the briefing room.
"Have a seat, please," Ringgold said.
Kate suspected she was about to get some very bad news as Sammy, Sean, and Carr dropped into seats beside her.
"There was another attack on Outpost Portland after I saw you," Ringgold said. "Beckham and Horn are still okay, but we lost a lot of people."
"No," Kate stammered.
"How? I thought...
The collaborators used bats strapped with explosives to attack the outpost, Sousa said.
Bats? Kate was taken completely off guard. How in the world could they control them? Sean asked, face going pale.
It could be any number of things, Sammy said. Some kind of implanted microelectrodes, radio telemetry systems that deliver microcurrent pulses, maybe. There's so much documented research in this area to draw from.
If they can control bats, think about what else they can control, Carr said. The scientific implications, they're frightening. The result was certainly devastating, Festa said. Whoever was responsible might have been inspired by the experimental bat bombs developing in World War II.
I wouldn't be surprised, Kate said. More alarming is that these bats could be mutated by VX-99.
Carr put a hand on his chin, deep in thought. That would explain how those animals could carry payloads with such catastrophic effects.
Every time we take one step forward, the variants and collaborators push us one step backward, Lemke said with a shake of his head.
How about the other outposts? Kate asked.
Sousa looked to Festa for a report. It was a tough night, said the lieutenant. Three of the six outposts around the target cities have fallen completely. I'm still going through all the data to figure out which are the safest outposts to evacuate survivors to.
This is why your work is so crucial, Ringgold said, her eyes looking between each of the researchers. We need to intercept the messages being sent on the webbing network if we have any hope of organizing our defenses appropriately. Right now, we're just evacuating people toward the Atlantic coast and hoping we can stop the advance of the creatures, Lemke added.
I think we're close enough to a breakthrough.
Kate set up her laptop and synced it with the briefing room monitor. She clicked on her touchpad. An image of the red webbing within a beer can-sized bioreactor appeared on the screen. Next to it was one of the computers that had been recovered from the collaborators at the Luray Caverns in Virginia.
What are we looking at now? Lemke asked.
We successfully recreated the webbing network, Carr said.
The connection between the computer and the neural cells was made with a flexible microelectric array.
Sammy swept her dreads over a shoulder.
It's very similar to a design documented as early as 2006 by Dr. Simon Wong at the University of Florida.
Without getting into specifics, Kate said.
Right, Sammy said. Bottom line, Dr. Wong showed that a group of rat neurons could be successfully paired with a fighter jet simulator program.
I remember that, General Sousa said. The DOD discussed investigating these topics to create better artificial intelligence for drones.
Did they?
Sean asked, leaning over the table. Yes, in fact, Sousa replied. The DOD picked up many of the researchers involved in these efforts and hired them to continue their work on these subjects.
By chance, are any of these scientists still employed by the Allied States? Kate asked.
Sean nodded.
If we knew who they were and had their help, they might be very useful.
I'll look into it, Sousa said, but I can't promise anything.
For now, let's assume you are the best minds we have left. Please continue, Ringgold said.
Soprano returned and passed out hot cups of coffee as Kate moved on to the next slide. A graph showed the electrical output from the webbing. Next to it were screen captures from the collaborators' computers that displayed a jumble of words.
We connected the wires from the collaborator's computer to the neural network contained within the webbing, Kate said. Sammy's help was instrumental in this part. By stimulating the cells, I recorded output signals from the webbing that were translated into inputs readable by the computers, Sammy added.
Carr motioned at the screen with his coffee cup. As you can see, while the computers could detect a signal, we couldn't produce anything that made a lick of sense.
Sammy agreed with a nod. I've got the best computer scientists on my team, but even we can't do anything to turn these images into something understandable. It's all just a bunch of gobbledygook.
How long do you need to decipher this? Ringgold asked.
What we have now is a slate full of hieroglyphics, Sammy explained. The symbols and the words are there, the message is there, but it's hidden. We need our Rosetta Stone to translate this.
Ringgold raised an eyebrow.
Tell me then, what is your Rosetta Stone?
Carr glanced at Kate while Sean rocked a leg. They all knew what the request meant. More soldiers were going to die.
It's a mastermind, Kate said. We need to connect the computers and neural network to one of those monsters in order to get a proper input signal. With that, we might get what we need.
You might? Sousa asked.
Our team agrees this is the best option, Sammy said. This should be enough to complete the circuit, so to speak, and decode this language the variants are using.
There's really no other way, Sean said emphatically. No intel could be better than working directly with a mastermind.
Lemke shook his head.
I don't like the uncertainty, especially if you're asking what I think you're asking.
This information will be invaluable to predicting their movements and tapping into their networks. Kate tapped on her laptop, and the monitor showed the collaborators' computer systems again. With it, we could even send signals of our own through the webbing. We could weaponize the enemy against themselves.
Ringgold looked to Sousa.
That's something our troops could use. Imagine the possibilities.
Our job would be a lot easier if we knew the variants' plans, Festa said.
Think about the lives we could save, Sean said.
I don't disagree, Sousa said. But this requires us to locate a mastermind, secure the area, and connect your computer contraption up to it.
That would be one method, Carr said. But not what we'd recommend. Science is best done in a controlled environment, in a place where we can modulate all the external stimuli to ensure that the language we decode is uncorrupted.
You want us to capture a mastermind and bring it in? Sousa asked.
I know it sounds insane, Kate replied. But we've done this before to study the variants and alphas. There's nothing like having that kind of research subject to ensure we succeed.
We suggest isolating and moving a mastermind to a defensible location with a large-scale laboratory infrastructure, Carr said.
Have you identified a place? Ringgold asked.
Sammy leaned forward in her seat, her tattoos peeking out from her cuffs.
That's where we were hoping you all might come in.
Festa nodded right away.
I think I know a place.
Outpost Manchester in New Hampshire might work. There's a cluster of manufacturing buildings there where they used to research and produce tissue-engineered organs. This is exactly the type of facility we could reuse for the mastermind.
That sounds ideal, Carr said.
They have had zero successful variant attacks due to their defenses, Festa continued. It's protected by bodies of water, rocky outcrops, and waterlogged topsoil that is nearly impossible for the beasts to tunnel into. The commander is a decorated veteran from the Great War of Extinction.
The room was silent for a moment.
I know what you all might think. Capturing a mastermind, relocating it, hooking it up to a bunch of machines and some outpost, Kate said. It's a huge commitment with resources we are desperately low on.
We understand what we're asking sounds ambitious, Carr said. Even foolhardy. But if we want to win this war against an enemy like this, we need to take big risks.
Ringgold stared at the computer monitor with the garbled message.
If we do this, if we can actually figure out how to bring in a mastermind and tap into their network, you truly believe we can not only intercept their messages, but also send signals to disrupt their communications?
Yes, Sammy said. Working firsthand with a mastermind will tell us what we need to know from a data perspective.
Kate sat straighter. With these revelations, we can eliminate the advantages the variants have over us.
Sean continued rocking his leg and nodded emphatically.
And with the new equipment S.M. Fisher and General Cornelius are bringing to the table, we can add a stronger layer of defenses to the outposts still standing, Ringgold said.
Kate thought of Beckham and Horn and their children. In her mind's eye, she saw all the other people they had left behind in Outpost Portland, like Donna and Beau and Timothy, all who could be dead now. They were among tens of thousands of people driven from their homes across the Allied States or dying at the claws of variants.
This plan might not be perfect, but it's the best we have, and we have to do whatever it takes to stop these monsters, Ringgold said.
I can get behind it, Lemke added.
General Sousa sat quietly, seeming to contemplate all they had presented. He finally stood and let out a brief sigh.
It's a risky plan, but you're right. It's the best we have. And fortunately for us, Team Ghost is already on their way to kill a mastermind. Lieutenant Festa, contact them and tell them their orders have changed from kill to locate and secure.
Team Ghost trekked through the outskirts of a flooded New Orleans. A chopper had dropped them off the night before under the cover of darkness. Since then, they had moved slowly to avoid enemy contacts. Fitz held point, listening for hostiles and Louis Armstrong Park as they approached the large white arch marking the entrance. The sun hid behind a blanket of dark gray clouds, and the city was quiet. Somewhere in the city, a lone rogue beast screeched, and a flock of birds exploded into the sky. Judging by the distance, they were out of the monster's scent range. Hopefully, the rub Team Ghost had used to mask their scent would protect them. Fitz gave the order to halt in front of the white arch that had Armstrong welded to it in big blocky letters. His blades creaked as he stopped in front of a thin film of murky brown water. The levees had failed years ago, and swamplands had reclaimed most of the terrain. He looked at Rico. Stains climbed up from her boots to her knees, showing the depth of the waters they had to pass. Soon they would have to cross more.
The French Quarter is only a block away. Keep your eyes peeled for any sign of the mastermind, Fitz said. Once we find it, we keep an eye on it and stay hidden until air support and backup arrives. When they do, we'll help hogtie that bastard and get it out of here for the scientists.
Hogtie? Mendez said.
Personally, I'd prefer to barbecue the damn thing and turn it into carne asada.
Don't disrespect carne asada, brother. That shit is good, Ace said.
True, Mendez smirked. I still can't believe they want us to capture this thing.
We won't be alone, Rico said in a low voice.
It should be easier than killing it, actually, Fitz said. Nothing involving variants is ever easy, Dohai said, eyes narrowed and tone gravely serious.
You're right about that, amigo, Mendez said.
Fitz pictured the last time they had come face to face with a mastermind. It had only been a couple days, yet it felt like eons ago. In that time, they had lost Lincoln and watched hundreds of good men and women die at Scott AFB.
Snap out of it, he thought. You've got a mission to complete.
You good, Fitzy?
Rico asked in a whisper, as if she could sense his thoughts.
As good as I could be after wading through polluted floodwater in the middle of variant territory, he said.
You?
Fine. But I sure as hell wish variants didn't know how to swim.
She started out over the rippling brown water filling the streets between the park and the French Quarter.
I always wanted to come to New Orleans, she said. Thought it would be romantic, like Paris or some shit.
Someday we'll go somewhere nice, he said. A beach, or the mountains, wherever you want.
Ace snorted.
All right, kids, let's focus.
Fitz nodded and scanned the terrain one last time. To avoid ambushes from the floodwaters, they had picked routes over higher ground, staying to decaying houses, restaurants, and bars as much as they could. The buildings were set nearly half a foot higher than the street, meaning that while the streets were flooded, there was usually no more than a couple inches of water in the buildings.
Dohai, you're on point, Fitz said. Keep us on dry ground or shallow water as much as possible. Find us a trail to that monster. And from here on out, cut the chatter.
The team set off through ankle-deep waters to cross the street from the park. Then, Dohai led them through a cemetery with raised stone graves. A crumbling angel statue with outstretched wings shadowed them, its head long gone as tendrils of green and brown vines grew over it. Water flowed around the graves, running toward the southern exit of the wrought iron fence tracing the cemetery's perimeter. Fitz took every step slowly, probing beneath the water's surfaces with his blades to ensure he didn't trip on some tangle of trash concealed by the murkiness. Caught against the fence were coffins that had been freed by the floodwaters. They had popped open like ruptured boilers. Their skeletal contents were picked bare. All the leathery or decayed flesh had been snacks for desperate monsters. Dohai held up a fist, and the rest of the team froze. He used two fingers to indicate he had spotted a potential contact toward the west. Through his loopholed Mark 8 optic, Fitz scoped in on the movement. Near the stone steps leading to a mold-covered house with broken windows, the water rippled as if something swam just beneath the surface. He held his sights on the movement and waited. The creature was drawing near, but Fitz gave the order to hold fire, not wanting to draw attention unless absolutely necessary. An elongated skull surfaced, and two beady black eyes surveyed the cityscape for prey. Those eyes sat atop a long maw full of needle-sharp teeth. Fitz lowered his rifle. It was just an alligator, far less dangerous than a variant with gills. Never in his life had he been so thankful to see the huge predator this close. He signaled for the team to stay put as the alligator propelled itself lazily down the street-turned river, its tail slowly undulating. Once it had moved out of sight in the opposite direction, they advanced again. Their route took them between buildings disintegrating from the unforgiving humidity and water lapping at their baseboards. Piles of debris lay strewn at the foot of the structures. They passed through the shadow of a hotel with wraparound cast-iron balconies, looking for any sign of the mastermind's presence. In the distance, the cries of hunting variants wailed through the city again. Dohai thrust his fist into the air. A chorus of clicking joints sounded to their south. Fitz strained to see the source of the noise, but saw nothing. The chatter and squawk of variants erupted again from a different direction. This time, a scream, all too human, pierced the din. The agonizing cries continued for a few seconds before going silent. It had definitely come from the center of the French Quarter. Maybe there were still people alive, people they could save with the airlift. Fitz found new motivation to find their target. If they could secure the area, they might be helping more than just the science team today. Dohai waved them onward. He guided the team through a series of restaurants and into a bar. At the back exit, Fitz gave him the order, and Dohai opened the door to a flooded alleyway. This time, Fitz stepped down a short set of stairs and waded into water that came up to his navel. Dohai suddenly grabbed him and yanked him back up the stairs and into the door as a splash exploded from behind a mostly submerged dumpster. The scaled body of an alligator shot through the water, headed toward the two men like a living torpedo. Dohai aimed his rifle right at the animal's center of mass as Fitz scrambled back inside, dripping wet. Before Dohai could squeeze the trigger, another creature burst from the water behind the gator. The yellow eyes of a variant glowed as the creature wrapped its sinewy arms around the alligator and chomped into the beast's armored neck. The animal rolled in the water, writhing desperately to shake itself loose from the alpha predator. Fitz and Dohai moved back into the shadows as a second variant surfaced, water sluiced down pale, veiny flesh. It waded over, claws extended, waiting to strike. Shrieks called out from a nearby shop. Fitz held the team there, waiting with his rifle aimed at the creatures in the flooded alley. The alligator finally stopped thrashing, and the circle of water turned an even darker shade of brown. The two variants ripped the alligator apart. Seeing no other beasts, Fitz ordered Dohai to take the two monsters down with his hatchet. Fitz pulled his knife. They moved into position and then tossed the sharp blades. The hatchet found a home in one of the variant skulls, but Fitz hit his target in the back. Dohai threw his own knife before the creature could let out a shriek. Both monsters slumped into the water, floating next to the disemboweled remains of the gator. Fitz waited another moment, then gave the advance. They moved out into the water, retrieved their weapons, and pushed on until they reached a street that had been spared from the floods. Red webbing plastered the sides of buildings framing the road. The organic ropes imprisoned the bodies of enough creatures to make Noah's Ark seem like a minuscule collection. All evidence of food that the mastermind would need to create its organic central command of the webbing network.
"We're getting close," Fitz whispered.
Suddenly, Dohai took shelter behind the charcoal husk of a delivery truck. The others sheltered behind the wall of a nearby building. Fitz tried to settle his thumping heart. A horde of variants surged through a water-filled street ahead. Fitz counted their numbers, watching them hurtle by. Some ran, splashing through the street on their way to the alley the team had just left behind.
"Go, go, go,"
Fitz whispered after the monsters passed. Team Ghost ran across the street, fighting through deeper water. Clicks from snapping joints and far-off screams of prowling variants haunted the city. Fitz's blade suddenly snagged on something before he made it to the other side of the street, stopping him in the middle of the open water. Rico halted and reached out to help. Mendez, still on rear guard, paused beside them, scanning the water. Fitz twisted his blade, bent down to remove it from whatever garbage it had gotten jabbed into. As he did, something burst from the water to his right. The armored flesh of a juvenile barreled toward Fitz. He couldn't move out of its way with his blade caught, and there wasn't time or space for a clear shot. Rico swung the butt of her rifle into the creature's face, then delivered a heavy kick into the monster's side that knocked it off course again. Blood gushed from the monster's crushed nose. Fitz swung his rifle up as the variant turned on Rico. It raised its claws as bullets lanced through the creature's chest, chewing through the bone and organs at near point-blank range. The choof, choof, choof of the suppressed rifle reverberated over the water, but the splash the dead monster made was even louder. It sank in front of Rico. If the rest of the variants hadn't known more than alligators were in their midst, they did now. Rico bent down, reaching into the water to help Fitz pry his blade loose. As soon as he was free, the shrieks of a dozen monsters rang out. They poured from the darkened buildings to the north and south.
"Run," he ordered.
The team sprinted onto another soaked street as the monsters pursued them. A half-crumbling spire of the St. Louis Cathedral speared the gray sky nearby. Dohai pointed to a museum across from Jackson Square in the center of the French Quarter. The team stormed past, rifles up as they moved into the lobby of the building. Rotting furniture and broken display cases lay in the water. The team splashed across the room toward the ticket counter where they took shelter. Red webbing grew across the walls, even denser here than when they'd seen it before outside. He crouched next to a pile of brown bones loosely wrapped in tendrils of red tissue. They were close. Fitz could feel it in his gut. Outside, the clamor of the variants went on for what felt like an eternity. But slowly, the monsters scattered, their wails becoming more sporadic, more distant, and their clicking joints fading as they searched for their lost prey. Fitz waited, letting the furor of the variants die down. Their angry voices were replaced by the drone of human voices in agony, sounding all too similar to the pained cries and moans the team had heard in other variant tunnels and Minneapolis. He had a feeling that those voices would lead them to the mastermind, or, if not the beast directly, then at least to its lair. Fitz signaled for the team to move back out toward Jackson Square. There, Dohai pointed out a path that led into the St. Louis Cathedral where the water began to recede. More red vines of tissue stretched out of the thin layer of water along the streets and grass up to the steeples of the church and into half-broken stained glass windows. The team skirted between the overgrown trees and bushes of the square, making their way to the former place of worship. As they closed in on the cathedral, moans traveled out of the broken windows. Fitz indicated for everyone to stay put, except for Dohai. Together, the two men climbed a short set of stairs and clung to the shadows until they made it into the nave. The missing roof allowed shafts of light that played across puddles of water between rotting pews covered in red webbing. Tendrils rose to the pillars in the middle of the space and clung to the stained glass windows. Cocoons of the red tissue pasted decaying corpses along the walls. Many were nothing but skeletons and flags of leathery brown flesh. The bodies of different native wildlife were there. Fish, birds, even a gator. Other long strands of tissue dangled from the ceiling, like bloody icicles. At the bottom of those macabre vines hung more bodies. These were all human, wrapped up like a spider's prey. Dozens of variants climbed up and down those growths, picking at the animals and people suspended in them. Many of the victims moaned in agony. At the rear of the cathedral, past the sanctuary and altar, was a massive creature that stood nearly four times Fitz's height. Large, pink folds of skin covered the beast, and its Stygian eyes peered around at its surroundings. It stuck to the shadows, apparently wary of the light plunging in through the massive holes in the ceiling. Fitz slowly backed away with Dohai. They hurried down the stairs and joined the team back on Jackson Square.
"Rico," Fitz whispered. "Radio command. We found the ugly son of a bitch."
Chapter 13. The cool morning air reeked of death and suffering. Beckham and Horn waited outside the maintenance warehouse on the University of Southern Maine campus. Lawnmowers and equipment sat outside to make room for body bags. The inside had been turned into a makeshift morgue for the victims of the attack. Like so often before, Beckham wondered why fate had chosen to take Beau and Donna. So many other innocent men, women, and children had perished, gone in an instant, or cursed to horrific burn injuries, their moans still haunting the campus. And somehow he had once again been spared, left alive to watch all these people suffer. Beckham looked up to the sky, but he didn't curse God, nor did he question why God might allow atrocities like last night. He had always believed that if there was a God, he had nothing to do with what happened on Earth. Humans had to live with the consequences of their actions, good or bad. Lately, Beckham had seen too much of the bad, especially this morning. Soldiers and volunteers continued to carry body bags into the warehouse. In some cases, the bags looked light. Not much remained of the deceased. The real weight was on the minds and hearts of the survivors. Another pickup truck pulled up. Civilian volunteers lowered the lift gate to reveal more bodies, these ones without the luxury of body bags, people who had likely died in triage. In the past, with the proper treatment, some of them might have survived. But out here, the medical staff simply didn't have the supplies or equipment needed to treat them. Beckham still didn't know how the collaborators had controlled the bats or what type of explosives they were rigged with. But he had a feeling this was just one of many tricks they would use to win the new war. Between those new weapons and the conspirators within their ranks, he feared the enemy was far stronger than anyone realized. "Fucking animals," Beckham growled. First Jake, then Timothy, and now Donna and Beau. All killed by the collaborators. Those people were worse than terrorists. They were demons. He gritted his teeth and punched the side of the metal siding, denting it with his fist. Blood filled the cracked skin over his knuckles. It wasn't his hand that hurt the worst, though. His head still throbbed from the truck wreck. He closed his eyes and drew in a breath to manage the pain until it passed. Horn didn't say anything. The two men had barely slept in 24 hours of hellish insanity, and they were at their wits' end. A side door to the maintenance building opened, and a soldier stepped out, gesturing for them. "Captain, Master Sergeant, the bodies are ready for you to identify," said the young man. Beckham and Horn followed him inside. The door clicked behind them a moment later, sealing them in the long space. 80-some corpses lay on the concrete floor in zipped-up black body bags. Another soldier with a clipboard walked up and down the aisles, checking off names on his list. "Captain Beckham and Master Sergeant Horn are here to confirm the identity of the deceased, Donna and Beau Tufo," their escort said to the soldier with the clipboard. He glanced at his board and then looked across the room. "Please come with me, sir, Master Sergeant." Beckham and Horn followed the soldier until he stopped at two body bags. "These are them," he said. Horn bent down and unzipped the bag on the left, the odor of charred flesh exploding out.
"Christ have mercy," he muttered, covering his face with his wrist.
Beau Tufo's face was hardly recognizable. Scorched and disfigured, his features had melted into a hideous sight. Beckham pictured the young boy he had rescued during Operation Liberty. He had survived the monsters and grown up into a young man, only to die at the hands of humans. Bile rose in Beckham's throat.
"This is Beau Tufo," Horn managed to mumble.
The soldier with the clipboard nodded, and Horn unzipped the second body bag. Donna didn't look as bad as her son, partly due to the fact Beau had shielded her from the blasts. Despite his sacrifice, he hadn't saved her. And maybe that was for the best, Beckham thought. The two were so close that they wouldn't have survived without each other. Beckham stood, his blade creaking.
"This is Donna Tufo," Horn said.
"Thank you," said the soldier. "For my records, they don't have any other kin here, is that correct, sir?"
"Yes," Beckham said.
"Would you like us to take care of the burial, or..."
"We'll do it," Beckham said.
Donna and Beau deserved to be buried together on Peaks Island, where they had enjoyed a hiatus of peace in the middle of this endless war. The soldier nodded and stepped away. Beckham began the short walk to the exit of the maintenance building. Each step felt like a mile. His head spun. The black body bags stretched in all directions. It was too much, even for him. When he got outside, he vomited into a bush. Horn patted him on the shoulder, but didn't say anything. "I'm good," Beckham said, wiping his lips. He drew in a breath and started back to the campus with Horn. Chimneys of smoke rose from the damaged rooftops where suicidal bats had flapped into the sides. Soldiers had reclaimed some of the positions, but what could they do against another attack like that? Beckham started the march to the command tent on campus.
"Are we going to head back to the George Johnson after we bury our friends, or do you want to keep looking for Timothy?" Horn asked.
Beckham drew in a breath. They both knew the odds of finding the young man alive were slim to zero.
"If we go back out there looking for him, we're not coming back, Big Horn."
Horn rubbed his neck, wincing at the reality. They fell into silence until they got back to the command tent. Beckham pushed past the flap to go inside where Lieutenant Niven was going over maps with Sergeant Ruckley. They both stood at the table. There were no good mornings or salutes, only the hard looks of soldiers that had just gotten their asses handed to them and fully expected more.
"Have you heard anything from SOCOM?" Beckham asked.
"We spoke to Lieutenant Festa, but our orders have not changed," Niven said. "We are to hold this post at all costs."
Ruckley raised her chin a bit, clearly wanting to say something. If Beckham had to guess, she didn't like those orders.
"People are being evacuated across the Allied States, and we're expecting to receive over 100 refugees by tonight," Niven continued. "We've been marked high on the safe list."
"How the hell did that happen?" Horn muttered.
"I guess Command thinks since we don't have issues with tunneling variants, we're safer than other outposts."
"Yeah, but those bats might be worse," Horn said. "Plus, we got sleeper cells wreaking havoc inside our borders. Tunneling variants aren't the only damn issue we should be worried about."
"All I know is that I'm staying put until Command says otherwise," Niven replied.
"How about you two?" Ruckley asked. "What's your next move?"
"We're going to bury our friends on Peaks Island and then return to Command," Beckham said. "We'll see if we can get you some extra support," Horn said.
"The Iron Hogs are grateful for whatever we can get," Niven said. "I'll get a bird ready for you after you're finished with the burial."
"Sir, permission to accompany them to Peaks Island," Ruckley said. Niven paused, seeming to think on it. "It won't take long, sir," Ruckley said. "They'll need some help. And besides, it's the least we can do."
"Approved, Sergeant. But make it fast, okay?" Niven said.
"Yes, sir," Ruckley said.
"Thank you," Beckham said.
"I'll meet you in the staging area," Ruckley said. "Give me 10 minutes.
"For what it's worth, I'm very sorry about your friends," Niven said.
"Me too," Beckham said.
He walked away with Horn while Ruckley made a call over to the morgue requesting Beau and Donna's bodies be prepared for their arrival.
"You want to call Cade about Beau and Donna?" Horn asked.
"I don't want to give her the bad news until I can do it in person. Besides, she's got so much on her plate already. And Niven already informed SOCOM last night we're okay."
"Good point."
Horn wagged his head.
"Man, Tasha is going to be a wreck when she hears about Timothy. I promised her I would."
Beckham put a hand on his friend's shoulder. On their walk to the staging area between Woodbury Campus Center and Masterton Hall, a line of military transport trucks passed by. The beds were filled with equipment and soldiers. Many of them looked no older than Timothy had been. The staging area, too, was a flurry of activity between stacks of shipping containers. Militia and soldiers listened to orders from their leads. People in civilian clothing lined up, too, joining the call to arms after witnessing yesterday's events.
"Jesus, that kid looks like he's 10, Beckham said, nodding toward one.
The cost of the war was never more evident. While he and Horn had saved Tasha and Jenny from the fighting, Beau had lost his life, and Timothy had almost certainly lost his against the collaborators and variants. Now kids younger than 18 were joining up to fight.
That was something Ringgold had fought so hard against. And now they had no other choice, as those men and women of fighting age perished in the variant's attack. Ruckley showed up with the truck a few minutes later. Two body bags were in the bed, along with shovels. They took the truck to the shoreline where a speedboat was tethered to a dock. Four soldiers standing guard ran over to help them unload the body bags and joined them in the boat. The ride to Peaks Island was quiet. Horn and Beckham watched the horizon in a trance. They had both dreamed of returning home, but doing so like this was more nightmare than dream. The island loomed ahead of them, and Ruckley looked back from the wheel. "Which way?" she called out over the motor. Horn pointed toward the shoreline where they had all lived. The boat curved over the water, thumping against the waves. Beckham's heart accelerated with the engine when he saw his home, or at least what was left of it. Charred skeletal boards and a brick foundation were all that remained. Beckham grabbed handholds on the gunwale as he climbed toward the bow for a better view. The boat passed houses on the shore, none of which had been hit. The only destroyed home was the one Beckham had shared with his family. He was too upset to consider the implications.
"Damn, boss," Horn said.
"Is that your house, Captain?" Ruckley asked as they pulled up to the dock.
"It is, was, my house," Beckham said.
The four soldier escorts jumped out and tied the boat off on the dock's pilings. Then they got the body bags out and hauled them to the shore with Horn and Beckham.
"Where to?" one of the soldiers asked.
"This way," Beckham said, leading them to the tree where a stone marked Apollo's grave and the grave of his female companion. The branches creaked in the breeze, saved thankfully from the flames.
"Here is good," Beckham said.
Ruckley instructed the four soldiers to start digging with her, while Beckham trudged over to look at the remains of his house.
"I'm so sorry, man," Horn said.
Beckham stopped just outside where the back door had been. A metal picture frame had melted on the remains of a metal bedside table, the picture erased into ash. They walked around the crumbled side of the house together to the front, when Horn suddenly halted.
"Fuck!"
Horn yelled. The soldiers all came running, shovels discarded and rifles shouldered.
"What? What's wrong?" Ruckley said.
Horn stared across the street at the remains of the house where he had raised Tasha and Jenny for the past 8 years. For a moment, no one said anything. But realization hit Beckham when he scanned the rest of the road. The other houses on the block were spared from the explosions and flames.
"This isn't a coincidence," Ruckley said.
"We were targeted," Beckham said.
Beckham thought back to the collaborator in Boston that knew his name, and then the attack on the lab that nearly killed Kate. There was no doubt in his mind now.
"Someone in Portland is compromised," Beckham said, "and this was a message." "Why not just shoot us?" Horn growled. "At least then I could see the slimy fuck's face and fight back."
Beckham grabbed his rifle, a chill running up his spine. The other soldiers raised their weapons again, slowly turning.
"It's not safe here," Ruckley said.
"Fuck this. I'm gonna skin the little prick alive," Horn said. "Or pricks. Hell, I'll take on an entire fucking army."
"Calm down," Beckham said. Horn kicked a burned board.
"This is our goddamn home, boss," he said. "They killed our friends, destroyed our houses. They're after our whole damn country. I want to find the motherfuckers and kill them all."
Ruckley spat on the ground.
"You're welcome to stay here and help me find them."
Beckham tried to bite back his own fury. Revenge could wait. There were more important matters at hand.
"First, we bury our friends, so they can rest in peace," he said.
Hours ago, Fisher had left El Paso, Texas. He and his men had left Sergeant Sharp behind with Lieutenant Riggs to guard the seismic detection trucks. Sharp would then oversee the deployment of a seismic detection truck near Outpost Galveston. But what they needed now was a way to deploy this technology across the Allied states. Cornelius had requested Fisher to come to Outpost Manchester in New Hampshire to focus on a new mission implementing seismic detection defenses. Fisher wasn't sure yet how they were going to do it with limited manpower, and the equipment they had scrounged up wasn't enough for more than a few outposts.
The trucks were already being deployed, but simply couldn't cover the ground they needed to adequately defend the Allied states. Apparently, Cornelius had something else in mind for Manchester. The town had once been a mill town bisected by the Merrimack River and later evolved into a center for high-tech startups and niche businesses. The place appeared to Fisher as if it was on the next stage of its life, currently occupied and defended by a combination of General Cornelius's army and the Allied States' military. At Cornelius's behest, Fisher had gone with Chase and Tran to an office building overlooking the Merrimack for a meeting and call with the president. He entered a conference room with his two guards.
"Mr. Fisher, it's good to see you again," General Cornelius said.
He was polite, but he remained seated behind a long mahogany table, a laptop resting in front of him. Not rising was a reminder who was in charge here. Four officers wearing the Orca badge and blue armband of his private army also remained seated in brown leather chairs. Three empty fabric-covered chairs stood nearby, looking out of place. Fisher shook hands with Cornelius across the table and then took a seat with Tran and Chase.
"You all outperformed my expectations in El Paso," Cornelius said. "We'll deploy this strategy across the Allied States as soon as possible. Hopefully this will buy us the time to destroy the brains of the variant network. But unfortunately we are running out of time."
"Some outposts have already ran out," Fisher said. "I heard we lost 8 last night."
"Actually 10, Cornelius said. Tran and Chase exchanged a look, but Fisher remained stern-faced. The losses were hard to stomach, but he couldn't let himself dwell on them. They had to focus on preventing further damage.
"Our enemies unleashed a new weapon," Cornelius added. "Somehow they rigged bats with explosives and set the damn things loose on Outpost Portland."
"Good God," Fisher said, unable to contain himself.
"We thought by moving to places like Manchester we would be safe from the tunneling variants. But the bats have added another threat into the mix," Cornelius said. "Fortunately, we have a secret weapon of our own."
Fisher leaned forward, curious.
"SOCOM is helping organize the evacuation and defense of strategic bases around the Allied States, and we've been asked to help with Manchester's defenses," Cornelius said. "This city was once the site of advanced biotechnological research. It will make a perfect research space for Dr. Lovato and her team."
"Research space for what, exactly?"
"As we speak, teams are working to capture a mastermind and bring it here for the scientists to study."
Chase laughed. "You can't be serious."
Cornelius didn't laugh.
"Wait, you're really not joking?" Chase asked.
"Not at all," said the general. "They have the beast surrounded right now."
Fisher stroked his mustache nervously, then realized what he was doing and stopped.
"What in the Sam Hill are they thinking bringing one of those creatures here?"
"The scientists think it will allow us to tap into the variant communications network. Needless to say, we have reason to believe the variants are going to want it back. It's up to us to ensure that doesn't happen."
Cornelius rotated his wrist to check his watch.
"It's about time to call President Ringgold."
He turned to one of the officers next to him, who in turn used a satellite phone.
"What I've been investigating will provide us unparalleled defenses in Manchester and the rest of the country," Cornelius said. "Better than the trucks you used in El Paso."
Fisher was anxious to hear what that might be when a voice came over the phone's speaker.
"President Ringgold here."
"Madam President, this is General Cornelius. I have S.M. Fisher with me in Manchester."
"Hello, gentlemen. I'm with Vice President Lemke, General Souza, and Lieutenant Festa."
"Before I begin, I just want to express my sympathy for everyone and everything we lost last night," Cornelius said.
There was a pause on the other end of the line.
"Thank you. And, frankly, we're running out of time to save everyone else," Ringgold said.
Fisher thought he detected Ringgold's voice shaking slightly. He had once thought that she was a coward running off to a ship far from land, but he knew she cared deeply for the people of this country.
"I'll get right to it," Cornelius said. "Mr. Fisher has proved seismic detection allows us to accurately detect and locate variant tunnel activities in El Paso. I've identified a location with technology even more advanced than what Mr. Fisher used. When I was involved with the Department of Defense, one project I encountered consisted of advanced detection systems for tsunami and earthquake activity."
General Souza came back on the line.
"I vaguely remember that.
Wasn't that one of the DARPA-funded environmental warfare projects near Stanford?
Yes. It was called Project Rolling Stone.
Researchers at the National Accelerator Laboratories were devising a system to detect seismic aberrations that might lead to a catastrophic environmental event. But that wasn't the only use they saw fit for this program. Fisher raised a brow, intrigued by where this was going. North Korea has a long history of attempting to tunnel under the demilitarized zone, Cornelius explained. South Korea needed something to detect those tunnels before they hit Seoul, and they reached out to us. Hence, Project Rolling Stone took on a new goal.
Pardon me, but if this project already exists, what did you need the vibro-size equipment for in El Paso? Fisher asked.
Cornelius gave Fisher a knowing nod. The answer is twofold. First, the technology developed in Project Rolling Stone is still out in California, deep in the heart of variant-controlled territory. Second, if I was going to even suggest we consider retrieving it, we needed to show that seismic detection and location works.
We don't have nearly enough of those vibro-sized trucks for every outpost. How will we guarantee there's enough of this Project Rolling Stone equipment? And even if we have the equipment, how do we find the people to help run it? Ringgold asked.
When I retired, we had enough equipment to deploy all over the DMZ, plus surplus to detect environmental seismic events across the Pacific Northwest, Cornelius replied.
Fisher was impressed with the idea so far, and listened anxiously. We can deploy this new technology in Manchester as soon as it arrives with Mr. Fisher's help. But in the meantime, we will deploy the few vibro-sized trucks we have at outposts they are needed the most, Cornelius said. Then we'll roll out these Rolling Stone technologies to outposts all around the country.
General, said a new voice, this is Lieutenant Festa. France has sent us 100 consultants, engineers, soldiers, and more, with experience finding and fighting the monsters that dug through the ground in Europe. I believe that should help with the manpower issue.
And we have the people and enough equipment to cover far more ground than the vibro-sized truck setups we used last night, Cornelius said. One seismic detection system, or SDS, from Project Rolling Stone can cover a radius of approximately 200 to 500 square miles, depending on geological factors. In other words, it will be more than enough for the outposts you decide to save, Sousa cut in. We're abandoning outposts in the Midwest and continuing to pull people back east.
Festa spoke up again.
That's great that we might be able to scrounge up this equipment. But our aircraft are at their limits of use right now. What exactly does this SDS stuff look like? Is it hard to transport?
Cornelius unfolded the laptop in front of him.
I'm sending you schematics of what this is so you know what to expect. Goes without saying this was a highly classified project beforehand, and I think we need to keep this intel amongst ourselves for the time being.
The general twisted the laptop enough so that Fisher could get a look at the images on the screen. On it, Fisher saw an array of metal-encased sensors, all of which looked similar to the small coin-sized sensors civil engineers used on bridges to detect stability issues and potential damage from traffic and floods. Each sensor could easily fit in the palm of his hand.
As you can see, the sensors are quite small. It's no problem to scatter these around an outpost.
Cornelius opened another image.
This is our signal processing unit.
A backpack-sized metallic device with a computer screen and an array of antenna came on the screen.
Remember, these were only meant to be passive detection systems, not active like the equipment we used in El Paso, Cornelius said. All they've got to do is receive even the most minute of signals from tunneling activity, and you can get an accurate read on any tunnel making. Like I said, perfect for the DMZ between North and South Korea.
That certainly exceeds my expectations if it works how you promised, Fisher said.
Me too, Ringgold said. This sounds like something we can't pass up. Let's get it done.
It's not that easy, Cornelius replied.
Tell me what you need.
My troops are made up of mercenaries, retired soldiers, and a lot of brave men and women. But these are not special ops soldiers, and that's what I need to help locate the tech before our people can get it out of there.
Hushed chatter came over the other line.
Anything could have happened to the SDS equipment since I last heard about it. The facility may have been inadvertently destroyed in the bombing campaigns in the war, or marauders may have sacked the National Accelerator Labs, Cornelius said.
We need a team with the experience of working behind enemy lines.
I know of just the one, Ringgold said. Unfortunately, they're busy trying to secure a mastermind.
A mission to locate and retrieve this technology is imperative to protect the mastermind while the scientists research it, Cornelius replied. This location is one of the hardest to get at, but that doesn't mean it can't be done if the variants try.
There was silence on the phone for a few seconds. Fisher had made some tough decisions in his time, but he did not envy the president's position now. Every soldier they had left was a valuable asset from a dwindling pool of resources.
General Cornelius, I want you to send myself and General Sousa all the intel you have on Project Rolling Stone, Ringgold said. We'll need it if we're going to send a team out looking for it.
Uploading now, Cornelius said.
Thank you. We will be in touch shortly. Until then, stay safe.
You too, Madam President.
The call ended, and Cornelius stood.
I'm counting on you now, Mr. Fisher, he said. As soon as the SDS equipment arrives, I want your men ready to deploy it. In the meantime, I'll be heading back to Galveston.
He crossed around the table closer to Fisher.
There's something else I want to warn you about.
What? Fisher asked.
We have good reason to believe most of these attacks have been aided by collaborators within and outside of the outposts.
Fisher furrowed his brow.
You're telling me there are traitors in our midst?
A firm nod.
What you and the rest of the people are doing in this base is extremely important. Between the mastermind and the SDS equipment, these are perhaps the most crucial missions if we're going to beat the variants and their allies.
I'm all too aware of it.
There very well could be people at this outpost that are compromised. You might run into some of these collaborators here on base and not even realize it. I want you to be vigilant, and I trust you can make sure the SDS equipment is safe when it's brought here.
Fisher swallowed.
I'm good judge of character, but stay frosty at all times and keep all classified intel quiet. The collaborators might be planning something even more sinister, and we can't afford any of our plans to fall into their hands.
That sounds like you don't think our military and its scientists can keep a secret, Fisher said.
Unfortunately, from what I've heard and seen, it sure as hell seems like we've got compromised people who have sufficient security clearance to intercept classified data.
Then who do I trust out here? Fisher asked.
Cornelius drew in a breath.
Wish I could tell you exactly who to trust and who not to. But if we'd figured that out already, I wouldn't have to give you this warning, would I?
Fisher swallowed even harder.
All I can say is use your brain, use your gut, and trust basically no one, Cornelius said.
He gave Fisher a nod, and then exited with his team behind him.
Chapter 14
Ghost, Falcon 1, ETA 5 minutes, came a voice over the channel.
Dohai and the rest of Team Ghost had been patiently waiting for this moment, all of them spread out and hidden in vantage points covering Jackson Square around the St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans. After calling in the mastermind's location, they had retreated to observe the beast through the cracked and broken stained glass windows. Dohai watched the abomination with a growing dread. He had grown up listening to Navajo folklore about many different demons, and had always believed them to be more fantasy than fact. But this beast proved his ancestors were right.
Eyes on target, Fitz responded over the channel. Awaiting orders.
4 birds incoming, 2 to touchdown, Falcon 1 called back.
Confirm LZ clear?
The channel went quiet. Dohai scanned the flooded terrain filled with debris and charcoaled vehicles around Jackson Square.
Negative, Fitz finally replied. Not enough room to land you, Falcon 1.
Understood, Ghost 1. We'll find an alternative.
The distant whir of the helicopters rose over the clicking of joints and the moans of the monster's captives inside the cathedral. A howl burst over the din, the variant version of an air raid siren sounding the alarm over the helicopters. From his position, Dohai could see the beasts cease feeding their master. Several of the smaller monsters skittered over the webbing toward the broken windows and doors.
Eyes on movement, Fitz said over the private channel.
7 hostiles from the south, Rico reported. Next came Mendez.
Got a pack of juvies streaming out of the apartments to our east.
Four more around the museums to the northwest, Ace chimed in.
The whoop of the chopper blades cut them off. Dark silhouettes appeared in the rolling gray clouds.
We're drawing heat, Falcon One said over the comms. Got a horde growing in our wake. Ghost, you'll need to clear the pickup zone.
We'll go, Fitz said.
All right, boys and girls, you heard him. We keep this square clear, then move inside and secure the cathedral. On my mark.
There was tension in his voice. Dohai was nervous, too. They were about to attempt something no other team had tried, and he had a feeling it wasn't going to be easy, even with the air support en route. The other members of the team shouldered their rifles, standing amid the overgrown bushes and masses of webbing. Dohai spotted an armored juvenile variant with roving, saucer-shaped eyes.
Execute, Fitz ordered on the comms.
Dohai pulled the trigger, and suppressed rifle shots choofed all around the square. Their targets crumpled, red holes weeping from heads and chests. The next volley punched through the flanks of the variants drawn out of the cathedral by the noise. Through the gaping holes in the windows of the cathedral, Dohai saw the mastermind go mad behind the altar where it stood. The hulking red form shook, the vibrations traveling through the folds of tissue that covered the monster. It reached out with huge, glistening claws and yanked on the tissue vines attached to its body like it was orchestrating a sickening puppet performance. Multiple cocooned bodies were slashed open by the raging beast, dumping the contents to the floor.
South square clear, Rico said.
North clear, Ace said.
Fitz gave the advance signal. Dohai got up and walked at a hunch past the foliage and webbing he'd sheltered behind, moving across the lawn toward the cathedral. A clearing in the clouds let sunlight wash over the choppers. Their shadows surged over the hellish cityscape. Screaming variants chased after them on all fours. It wouldn't be long before the reinforcements arrived. Team Ghost had to move. Keeping low, Dohai took point, with Fitz and Ace converging on him at the cathedral. At the south entrance, Rico and Mendez had joined up. One of the stained glass windows suddenly burst into rainbow shards. Dohai brought an arm up to shield himself from the hailstorm of glass as a variant lunged through. A suppressed burst took it down, and Fitz patted Dohai on the back.
You good?
He asked. Dohai wiped fresh blood off his cheek where a shard had opened his flesh. He managed a nod and followed Fitz and Ace into the nave of the cathedral. The mastermind thrashed around, knocking into the webbing-wrapped bodies dangling from the ceiling as it tried to separate itself from the organic netting in an effort to escape. The few remaining variants in the cathedral launched themselves off the rafters and webbing-covered walls. Calculated shots dropped them all before they could get within striking distance. Rico and Mendez joined the team in the nave, and they slowly surrounded the writhing beast.
Falcon One, Ghost One, Fitz said into his headset.